So before I begin the class, I'd like to just say something about Mother Manjari for the benefit of the regular members of our congregation, who's pretty much mostly everybody. How many people are here for the first time? Just a few. Okay. Welcome. Welcome. How many of you knew Mother Manjari? Mostly everybody who's regulars. So she was a very wonderful devotee. She lived here with her husband for, I think, 15 years, plus or minus. They were both devotees their entire lives, you know, from childhood on upwards. And they had a wonderful service attitude. They have a wonderful Krishna conscious son who is with us. He was on the altar this evening performing artik to Jagannath Baladev and Subhadra. And three Krishna conscious grandsons as well. But they themselves had a wonderful service attitude. So many devotees would receive prasadam. They were always looking for opportunities to serve the devotees, inviting devotees to their homes, serving prasadam, and showing an incredible example of, you know, being Krishna conscious. They would always be attending the program. Vidura, Mother Manjari's husband, he was on the altar till it was no longer physically possible for him to be on the altar. You know, he just, he was very, you know, surrendered in his service. And she was, you know, very Krishna conscious. I mean, she's always chanting. I mean, towards the, in the latter years of her life, she was chanting upwards of 64 rounds a day. Reading, you know, totally Krishna conscious person. And so, you know, she inspired us while, you know, she was here living with us, and even in passing away, she brought us all together. She was in a sort of like a, how would you say it? She was in bed for like more 2 weeks plus, practically eating nothing, but she wasn't leaving the body. And we would all come and gather together every evening in the room where she was staying and have kirtan. So I just always, when I think back upon that, I feel like it was some sort of special arrangement by Krishna to, you know, bring us all together. And even in her passing away, she was helping us in our Krishna consciousness by bringing us all together to perform kirtan for her benefit. So I think it was like an arrangement by Krishna. And so we're all very indebted, you know, to her. I think I speak for everybody when I say we're all very indebted to her and her husband for the wonderful example they gave us throughout their lives. And, you know, we're all missing them as well. But at the same time, I think we're all confident that they are someplace continuing their service. You know, they're continuing that devotional service that they were performing so nicely here. And maybe in, you know, the spiritual world, maybe some other place, but, you know, for sure, Krishna's, you know, reciprocated with them, done something very nice for them. So I just wanted to mention that, because this is, like Aunt Mabu mentioned, this was the first anniversary of her passing away. So, Mother Manjari Ki Jai. So we'll start the class. We'll read from this book, the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita means Song of God. It was spoken by God, Krishna himself, 5,000 years ago when he was personally present here on earth. So I'll just do a few, like, what might seem like rituals, but it's just the way we kind of enter into the class. And then I'll read a little something. I'll read one passage from the Bhagavad Gita and then try to kind of expand upon that. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, so we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, text 8. And I think I'm the only one with a book, so I'll just chant the Sanskrit once through and, read on. Sariram yadavapnoti. Wow, good audience. Yachchap yut kramatishvara. Grihit vaitani samyati. Vayur gandam ivasayat. Wow, that was really good. I'm impressed. Most audiences are very scared to do that. That was really good. Okay, I'll read the word for translation. We could say this responsibly. Sariram, the body. Yat, as. Avapnoti, gets. Yat, as. Cha api, also. Utkramati, gives up. Ishvaraha, the Lord of the body. Grihitva, taking. Itani, all these. Samyati, goes away. Vayu, the air. Gandhan, smells. Iva, like. Asayat, from their source. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The living entity in the material world carries his different conceptions of life from one body to another, as the air carries aromas. Thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. Purport. Here the living entity is described as Ishvara, the controller of his own body. If he likes, he can change his body to a higher grade, and if he likes, he can move to a lower class. Minute independence is there. The change his body undergoes depends upon him. At the time of death, the consciousness he has created will carry him on to the next type of body. If he has made his consciousness like that of a cat or dog, he is sure to change to a cat's or dog's body. If he has fixed his consciousness on godly qualities, he will change into the form of a demigod. And if he is Krishna conscious, he will be transferred to Krishna Loka in the spiritual world and will associate with Krishna. It is a false claim that after the annihilation of this body, everything is finished. The individual soul is transmigrating from one body to another, and his present body and present activities are the background of his next body. One gets a different body according to karma, and he has to quit this body in due course. It is stated here that the subtle body, which carries the conception of the next body, develops another body in the next life. This process of transmigrating from one body to another and struggling while in the body is called karshati, or struggle for existence. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminitya Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Pastacharishtani Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunachananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudi Gaurav Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So I'm going to reread one sentence which is a very, this kind of holds the theme of this entire purport. Prabhupada says, it is a false claim that after the annihilation of this body, everything is finished. Now that's a powerful statement. That's a big statement. It is a false claim that after the annihilation of this body, everything is finished. Well, first of all, what's a claim? So, we have to understand what that is before we can really analyze and understand the sentence properly. So I looked it up in the dictionary. It says, claim, state, to state or assert that something is the case, typically without providing evidence or proof. Okay? That's a claim. So in other words, there's a difference between, say, a claim and a fact. You know, fact is, well, there's proof. But a claim is, you're saying, you're stating that that's, this is the case, or asserting, but, as it says here, typically without providing evidence or proof. So now, let's analyze this sentence in that light. Prabhupada's saying it is a false claim. You know, there's no evidence or proof, basically what he's saying. It's that after the annihilation of this body, everything is finished. Now, somebody, upon hearing that, might come back and say, somebody who wasn't a devotee, let's say, an educated person, a person of average intelligence, hearing that, they might say, what the heck are you talking about? With all due respect, what are you talking about? How could you make that statement? If anything, it's the other way around. You see, because a claim, as we said here, is, you know, something without evidence or to support of it. How could you say that there's, you know, it's a false claim that after the annihilation of this body, everything is finished? If anything, as I said, it's the other way around. Because what do we see? What we see is that people die, and that's it. Generally, that's what we see. If you want to call something a false claim, it's a false claim to say that after the annihilation of body, everything isn't finished, because that's what we see. That, you know, practically that's everybody's experience all over the world for who knows how many thousands of years, right? When the person dies, seems like everything's finished. You don't hear back from them, and they don't rise from the dead, and you don't hear back from them, and like that. So, somebody could say that. So that, you know, in what sense is it a false claim that at the annihilation of this body, everything is finished? Well, a friend of mine told me something interesting. He said that how did he put it? Well, he made the point that it's only, you only have absolute certainty in one field, mathematics. There's no absolute certainty in science. Actually, all you have in science is you have a case study supported by strong statistical evidence. Like, for instance, to give an example, somebody might say, when you open a laptop, it doesn't explode. Okay? That's a fact. Somebody might be presenting, that's a fact. How do you know? Well, I've opened up 100,000 or a million laptops. I've opened up a million different laptops, and none of them exploded when I opened it up. So therefore, I can say with great confidence that when you open a laptop, it doesn't explode. But could that person make that statement with absolute certainty? No, right? Because it could be the next laptop that he opens could explode. See? So, there's a great amount of statistical support there, but you can't make a statement of absolute certainty like that. Only in mathematics, as I said, do you have absolute certainty. Like it's, you know, like for instance, one of a theorem of mathematics, if I remember correctly from way back in my high school days, the square, how does it go? The square of the hypotenuse in a right triangle, the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the square of the two other sides. And that's always going to be true. That's a statement you can make with absolute certainty. Any right triangle, you know, whether this one is that long and that one is that short or that way, any right triangle, okay, the square of the hypotenuse, you know, the two sides is going to be equal to the square of the hypotenuse when you add it all up. But in science, you don't have absolute certainty. You know, you have statistical support like that for certain statements. So here's something interesting. So, you know, we're saying here, there's a statement here that Let's find it again. It is a false claim that after the annihilation of this body, everything is finished. And as I said, somebody might counter saying, no, it's a false claim that at the annihilation of this body, everything isn't finished. It's because it appears that everything is finished. Well, we could come back and say, well, a Christian probably would come back and say, well, no, Jesus Christ, he rose from the dead. So there's an exception. And so you can't say that at the annihilation of the body, everything is finished. But I think I can come up with, present something to even much more recent and much more interesting than that, although that would be one example. Here, this is a book. It's called Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. So I'm just going to read one paragraph from the back jacket cover, which is, you know, might shed some further light on this discussion. It says here, children who claim to remember a previous life have been found in many parts of the world, particularly in the Buddhist and Hindu countries of South Asia. Among the Shiite peoples of Lebanon and Turkey, the tribes of West Africa, and the American Northwest, researchers have collected over 2,600 reported cases of past life memories, of which 65 detailed reports have been published. Specific information from the children's memories has been collected and matched with the data of their former identity, family, residence, and manner of death. Birthmarks or other physiological manifestations have been found to relate to experiences of the remembered past life, particularly violent death. See? So in other words, this is an interesting phenomena. It's been studied by a number of mainstream scientists. Well, not mainstream scientists, but scientists, but who aren't necessarily considered mainstream. But I mention this because this is the exception. You know, here's an example of what Prabhupada's saying, that at the annihilation of the body, everything isn't finished. I mean, they could question that, you know, so it's always could be argued, well, how do you know that's true? And let's check this out further. But science is based on empiric evidence. And is the quality of the evidence that's supporting the different theories that they're proposing? Like, what is the quality of the evidence supporting the Big Bang theory? Is it any better than the quality of evidence that's supporting this idea that, you know, that reincarnation is something that happens? Children remember their past lives. Well, that's not for me to say, really. Everybody have to do their homework and you could be the judge, but I would suggest that it's not. I would suggest that the quality of this research is probably as good, you know, equally on par with the quality of the research done by scientists to support other ideas like the Big Bang or the continental drift or whatever. You see? So in other words, there's what do you have? It's called it's like a standoff, a stalemate. Mm-hmm. No, it's impossible to establish empirically one way or the other who's correct. All right. So in other words, people will argue that, well, no, this evidence is not correct, and somebody else will argue, well, this evidence is correct. As I said, only in mathematics do you have absolute certainty. So what do you do? Where do you go from here? Well, one thing they do, actually, backing up a team, but so, you know, people are, they don't like this idea of having to accept claims, especially from religious books. That's something, you know, as far as like most modern day educated people are concerned, that went out like 500 years ago. Accepting the claims of a religious book. You gotta be kidding. You know? We want stuff that's scientific. This is the 21st century. Please, you know? Don't insult our intelligence by expecting us to accept claims from your religious book. Whether it's the Bhagavad Gita, the Bible, or the Torah, or the Quran. You know, we want something scientific. Right? That's kind of the mood of most people today. For knowledge, for anything serious, important, they want something. They want it scientific. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean to be scientific? Well, I looked up that word scientific, and the definition was based on or characterized by the methods and principles of science. Well, it says nothing. But then I looked up scientific principle because it said, you know, based on the methods, based on the character and characterized by the methods of principles of science. I looked, got a definition for that, and that gave me, you know, will give us a little further insight. So scientific principle, it says, one that is testable for consistency by performing an experiment. And it goes on to make a point. You can never prove anything absolutely this way, but you must be able to disprove it if it is wrong. See? So, you know, people want something that's scientific. So this approach is scientific, what I was just suggesting. And it was the evidence is this. Oh, cancellation. You have cancellation. In other words, the evidence that's sort of like suggesting that at the annihilation of the body, everything is finished. It's of no better quality than the evidence that's here that's supporting that at the annihilation of the body, everything isn't finished. So you have cancellation. You can't come to the conclusion. You can't conclude what's the truth by that process. It's like a stalemate, like in chess. You know, neither person can win. You can't. So it's called the stalemate. The game's over. So what do you do? How do we establish, how do we ascertain what is the truth? You know, what do we do? What are we supposed to, what is the meaning of life? What are we supposed to be doing? Well, one thing they like to do, they're very fond of doing in science, is to, you know, to arrive at their theories and like that. Is they make experiments, they perform experiments. You see? Just like I mentioned here, the consistency, a scientific theory is one that is testable for consistency by performing an experiment. They'll perform the experiment over and over again, and if they get, you know, the same result, then they can, you know, they'll conclude from that, well, look, this must be like this because we've done this now, you know, 1 million times, and each time it happened like this. And so that we could safely say that when you combine this with that, you're going to get that. You see? So my point is, though, then that so just like the scientists or people in general are very fond of making experiments and, you know, in an attempt to, for progress, you know, progress is based on scientific experiments. Progress means life getting better. Okay. So why not make a spiritual experiment? And as we're making, as you know, I say we, I'm talking about human, the race at large is making, I don't know how many material experiments. Why not make a spiritual experiment? That's what Krishna consciousness, that's what we're suggesting. Make a spiritual experiment. All right? In other words, we have a body of knowledge here which we are claiming is absolutely correct. But the process for real understanding that is you gotta just like in chemistry or physics or something like that, you gotta go into the lab. And you got to put on your, like, in, you know, when they go into the lab, they put on their white coat and their gloves and everything and their glasses and all. But, you know, you got to go in there and do the experiment. So the same thing in Krishna consciousness. We have a body of knowledge here, which we're saying is absolutely correct. And you have to go into the lab, which is your own consciousness. You know, you're the laboratory. And you have to perform the experiment. And then when you perform the experiment, if you do it, you know, according to correctly, according to the directions, then you'll experience eventually, you know, not necessarily right away, but you'll experience how, progressively, you'll experience how, yeah, there is, it seems to be correct. There's a nice verse earlier in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, when you are enlightened by the knowledge by which nescience is destroyed, then your knowledge will reveal everything, just like the sun lights up everything in the daytime. So, how does the sun light up everything in the daytime? Gradually. Happens gradually. Right? If you ever watch the sunrise from beginning to end, about an hour before the sun's going to rise, you see the first light in the sky. And then, you know, every minute it just gets, or every second it just gets a little bit lighter, a little bit lighter, a little bit lighter, until finally it's getting really bright and the sun pops up over the horizon. And then, you know, at that point you can see everything. You see? So it's like that. But it happens gradually. So it's the same thing. We're asking people, okay, come on. Let's, you know, fair go. You're making so many material experiments. You can't just dismiss this out of hand. You have to be prepared to make a spiritual experiment. You know? And if you do it, then gradually you will experience how there's something going on here. There's something to this, you know, this philosophy, and there's something to this way of life. It's not just how a lot of indoctrination. There's actually an experience, a spiritual experience to be had here. But once again, you have to make the experiment to have that, you know, to have that experience. You have to do it. Just like my spiritual master Bhaktisiddhanta, he used to give the example is if you've never tasted honey, and somebody hands you a jar of honey, and you want to understand what it's like, he said, if you lick the outside of the bottle, you'll never know. You're never going to be able to tell what honey tastes like by looking at the bottle or by licking the outside of the bottle. You got to unscrew the cap, stick your finger in there, get some honey on it, and pop it in your mouth and taste it. See? So it's the same thing. People, you could talk about this and argue about it until the cows come home, you know, but you won't get anywhere. You won't be any further. You won't understand anything more about Krishna consciousness, you know, by that process of being, you know, argumentative and analyzing, then you know, after a million years than you were after 5 minutes. You have to actually give this the benefit of the doubt and be prepared to perform the experiment. And then if when you do that, then Krishna becomes pleased actually by your efforts to, you know, do that. And then he reveals himself to you. I'll read a couple of interesting things to you, how it works. If I can remember where they are, yeah. Here's a little description of how the process of Krishna consciousness works. Man can, this is a sentence from the middle of a paragraph in one of a purport to a very important verse. It says, man can go on speculating for several millions of years, but if he is not devoted, if he is not a lover of the Supreme Truth, in other words, if he's not even prepared to give this philosophy, this knowledge, the benefit of the doubt, it says, he will never understand Krishna or the Supreme Truth. That process doesn't work. Prabhupada goes on to say, only by devotional service is the Supreme Truth, Krishna, pleased. And by his inconceivable energy, he can reveal himself to the heart of the pure devotee. That's what happens. You see? When you're willing to perform the experiment, which is what Krishna wants us to do, meaning engaging in devotional service, Krishna becomes pleased by that effort. And if you're doing it sincerely, then he'll, as it says here, he, by his inconceivable energy, he will reveal himself to the heart, to your heart, and you'll progressively understand him. Just like the sun lights up everything in the daytime, gradually, 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 you'll understand that how this is all true. Just another little insight into this, I think. Here's another sentence or two about this experiment, you know, how it has to... Prabhupada says, one has to approach a bona fide spiritual master to receive knowledge. Such a spiritual master should be accepted in full surrender and one should serve the spiritual master like a menial servant without false prestige. Satisfaction of the self-realized spiritual master is the secret of advancement in spiritual life. Inquiries and submission constitute the proper combination for spiritual understanding. Unless there is submission and service, inquiries from the learned spiritual master will not be effective. One must be able to pass the test of the spiritual master. And just like, once again, using that example of the experiment, just like when you're a student at school and you have chem lab, you got to pass the test of the professor. You got to, you know, do the experiments, but you can't just haphazardly. You got to do them carefully. You got to do them nicely. And, you know, when he's pleased, then you pass. You get a good grade. So I'm saying one must be able to pass the test of the spiritual master. When he sees the genuine desire of the disciple, he automatically blesses the disciple with genuine spiritual understanding. So, just to make a point here, this is not another process. You know, we just heard about how Krishna, by his inconceivable energy, reveals himself to the heart of the pure devotee. And here we're hearing about how the spiritual master automatically blesses the disciple with genuine spiritual understanding, or which one is it? It's both. They go hand in hand. The spiritual master and Krishna within the heart are kind of like on the same team. They're in cahoots, pardon the expression. But how it works is that, you know, Krishna's within our heart. He's aware of the psychic movements of every living entity. And so, you know, when a devotee is sincerely trying to engage in the process, then he simultaneously gets the blessings of the spiritual master and Krishna. Ultimately, it's Krishna who's, you know, revealing from within the heart, but you have to do that through the medium of the spiritual master. So anyway, yeah, so that's what we're here to do. We're trying to, you know, encourage everybody to make this spiritual experiment. And somebody's response might be, well, but wait a second, it sounds like it's going to be difficult. Yeah, but what's not difficult? Well, you know, you stop and think about it. What if it is a little bit difficult, or even a lot difficult? What's not difficult? Is getting a PhD or something like, is that easy? That's difficult, right? Any achievement, anything you want to achieve, you got to be prepared to undergo some difficulty, right? So that's not a valid objection. Might be difficult, or it's going to be difficult. Everything's difficult. Anything, you know, anything, any achievement, once again, it's going to be difficult. So we should really roll up our sleeves and, you know, perform the experiment. I mean, that's what we're here to try to encourage everybody to do. I mean, many people in this room here have been performing this experiment, engaging in devotional service for, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. I've been performing it now for 42 years. I'm getting close on completing my 42nd year. And I can honestly say I'm not like disappointed. I don't feel like, I'm not regretful. I don't feel like, boy, why did I do this? What a waste of time this was. No. I feel like I'm not satisfied with my results, in the sense I wish I would, you know, I would, were, how would you say, felt experiencing more spiritual realization, but at the same time, I feel something's happening. I feel like, you know, the process is for real. There's definitely something, you know, some transformation, you know, has taken place. I feel benefited as a result. Here's a good way to put it. If I had to make the choice all over again, I would make the same decision. You know, if I had to do all over again, I can honestly say I would do it again. I would decide to be a devotee of Krishna and do the same thing all over again. And say, now if I was having a very bad experience, obviously I wouldn't do that. But I can honestly say I would do that. So I'll wrap it up by just reading a paragraph which describes. This is from by one of our predecessor acharyas. His name was Rupa Goswami. And this describes the process of devotional service, this experiment I've been referring to throughout the class. So this is found in the last paragraph of a purport to a verse in the fourth chapter. So it says, according to the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, the science of devotional service, and then it says the Sanskrit, which I'll skip. Now here's the translation. In the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. Okay. So you have to have some desire to understand what's really going on here. Who am I? Who God is? What's my relationship? And you have to be prepared to, when you come in contact with this knowledge, if it sounds reasonable to you, you know, give it the benefit of the doubt. And then, yeah, we have to get up and do something about it. That's preliminary desire for self-realization. It says, this will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. So that's when the experiment really officially begins. You know, you come in contact with this, and you think that this sounds kind of interesting, and then you meet people who are seriously involved in the whole thing, and you get some inspiration from them. You could see that, well, wow, these kind of people are they're impressive. I mean, I have to admit, I'd like to have some of the qualities that they're displaying. I could see that, you know, I like what I'm seeing here. So you get, you know, more involved, and then eventually you take shelter of a a very advanced devotee and follow his instructions on how to perform devotional service, okay? And then at that point you're actually in really seriously performing the experiment. And here's what happens. Here's what's supposed to happen. Okay? Here's the result that we should experience. It says, by execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment, attains steadiness and self-realization, and acquires a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This taste leads one further forward to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage of life. So, I don't know, for me, that's very attractive. Because when I stop and think about, well, what is material life offering? What's the hope? What's the hope of really being real happy in material world? Well, from what I could see, it's pretty limited. Almost, I would say zero. In the sense that even the people who've had the best trot, so to speak, you know, it's temporary. I mean, I always reflect on this one person whose life I followed because I was interested in this kind of stuff before I even became a devotee, Jack LaLanne. How many have heard of Jack LaLanne? Okay. Not everybody, but a lot. He was like a fitness hero. He had a television show, I think it ran for 28 years. You know, and people watched him. He was, you know, mainstream America. They loved him. And the guy was amazing, you know. He lived till 96, and even in his 90s, he was kind of still active and healthy. But he only went till 96. So the point I'm making is even the people with the best karma, the absolute, you know, the best karma for health and wealth and fame or whatever, it's temporary. It's got to, you know, it's over, and that's it. BKS Iyengar, same sort of thing. He was, you know, great yoga teacher, healthy yoga teacher, very healthy and everything. But that's it. Bill Gates, he's still alive, but, you know, Howard Hughes isn't. And Getty, he's not. It's temporary. And another point that Bhagavad Gita makes is illusory. A lot of times when you look into the lives of these people who seem like they're extremely, incredibly materially successful, they have their trials and tribulations to deal with. It's not a cakewalk. You know, it might appear like we're thinking like, I wish I was like so and so, but if you knew more about the life of so and so, you'd find out that they have, you know, they have their things that they're dealing with as well. So here, on the other hand, what's being offered here is the highest prema. You know, we could come to something, real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage of life. So material life, the best it has to offer ultimately is possibly, and it's no guarantee, possibly you're going to have some, you know, happiness here in this world, being successful in some way or another, and then you die. That's the best case scenario for material life. But the best case scenario for spiritual life is that you become, you know, a fully enlightened, pure devotee of Krishna, and you experience prema, you know, love for Krishna, which is the highest perfectional stage of life. So if there's any at all, possibility that this could be true, you know, that this might actually be something that could be attained, don't you think it's worth like a little serious consideration? I do. That's why I'm doing it. See? So, yeah, this is the thought I'd like to leave everybody with tonight. That, hey, maybe this is true. I mean, maybe, you know, we have to jolt ourselves sometimes. Maybe this is Krishna consciousness philosophy is true. And in that case, we really have to, we have to look at our lives, and we have to think, okay, well, what should be my response? If this is true, ideally our response should be full surrender to Krishna. I mean, you know, just speaking like intellectually here, that's the only response that makes any sense. If this is true, Krishna really is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all the things he's saying here in the Bhagavad Gita are absolutely true, then, you know, the only sane, rational response would be, well, what do I have to do to surrender my whole life to Krishna? You know. So you have to really, this is something we have to think about. We have to constantly think about this. We have to ask ourselves, well, wait a second, what do I think about this? What do I think about this Krishna consciousness? Do I believe it's true or not? If I do, then what am I doing about it? Am I doing enough? You know, maybe I need to be doing more. And if you come back and you answer that to yourself, well, yeah, I do, then maybe it's time to ratchet it up a little bit. You know, the clock's ticking, time's a-wasting. You know, we got to try to make as much advancement as we possibly can in this lifetime. Anyway, I'll stop there. I don't want to just ramble on here. Thank you, everybody, for bearing with me. And do we have any questions or comments about anything I said? Did I succeed in boring everybody to... Yeah, Martha. Oh, the book here? It's called Where Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. No, what's that referring to is this, that he mentions it. He mentioned in that paragraph I read. Let's see if I could just quickly spot it. Here it is. Birthmarks or other physiological manifestations to relate to experiences of the remembered past life, particularly violent death. In other words, some of these kids who are remembering their past lives, they have a birthmark that matches the wound they got from the way they were killed in the previous life. Like some personality they remember. Some child is remembering, oh, in my last life, I was stabbed 7 times in the heart. You know, that's how I died. And then they look and they see, oh, you know, this has 7 stab wounds there that kind of match, that look just like a knife being, or they'll have like, you know, the child remembers being shot. I was shot, okay? And then they even get the reports, you know, what do they call them, post-mortem reports or something like that. The previous personality, sure enough, the previous personality died from a gunshot. And the bullet went in this side, and it came out that side. And the entry wound is smaller than the exit wound, which is makes sense, you know. In other words, they actually have birthmarks that match, that correspond to the mode of death from the previous lifetime. Now, how do you get that? How do you explain that? I mean, what's the material explanation for that? If when you're dead, this is because, you know, mainstream modern science today is saying when you're born, that's the beginning. Actually, being born is even... consciousness comes about at a mature stage of biological development, biochemical development, right? That would be a correct statement? Okay, that's what they're saying. And when that biological, biochemical arrangement breaks down, that's it, no more consciousness. And when you're dead, that's it, finished. That's the end of everything. Okay, all right. How do you explain this then? If that's the case, if consciousness is you know, something like a byproduct of some material arrangement, how do you explain that these kids are accurately remembering stuff from what seems to be a past life? It seems to indicate that consciousness is irreducible. It's not matter. It's not dependent upon matter. It's not created by matter. It's not annihilated by any breakdown of matter. It's something that's there, you know, eternally, right, continuously. And that's very significant for us because that very strongly supports the worldview that, you know, emerges from the Bhagavad Gita and all the Vedic literatures. And simultaneously, it very strongly contradicts the picture of reality that is coming forth from mainstream modern science, reductionist modern science, which is that, you know, when you're dead, that's the end of everything. And also the other major world religions, such as Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and whatever, you know. Their worldview is very strongly contradicted by this kind of evidence that consciousness continues from one life to the next. Because, well, let's use Christianity as an example, okay? Their idea is that when you're born, that's the beginning. They don't believe in pre-existence of the soul. Actually, one of the early church fathers, Origen, believed in that. And he became, I don't know what the word is, but eventually he became labeled as a heretic. You know, and there's some sort of statement that's considered considered heresy, actually, within the Christian religion, if you believe in the pre-existence of the soul. And they believe that when you die, one of two things happen. You go to heaven or you go to hell. There's no question of reincarnation, at least in Christianity, the way it's taught in contemporary human society. Reincarnation, that's another heresy, you know. So, okay, fair enough. Everybody's entitled to believe whatever they want to believe. But, hi guys, you know, here's this evidence. I mean, somebody could try to tear this apart and say, this is a lot of nonsense and they'll, you know, find faults in it. But if this is correct, and I'm not saying, you know, once again, it's empiric evidence. It's all always, as we said in the beginning of the class, you don't get absolute certainty from empiric evidence. But if that is correct, then by process of elimination, Krishna consciousness is really the, at least my way of thinking, is the only serious contender. Why would I be going looking for knowledge of absolute truth from a tradition that has such a fundamental thing, has a misconception about such a fundamental thing as what our real identity is? You know, why am I going to go look for absolute truth from people who are telling me that when I'm born, that's the beginning, and when I'm dead, that's the end of everything, when I know different, you know, from something that's also been scientifically researched, right? Or from a religion that's telling me that when I die, I go to one or two places, that's contradicted so, you know, powerfully by this evidence. You see? So what was your question again? I hope I gave a good answer, but I don't even remember. What was the question? Oh, no. It's that. Yeah. Yeah, one very famous composer, Mozart, everybody's heard of Mozart, and he's quoted as having said that when he'd be walking along, and he'd just be kind of, you know, walking along, taking a ride on a carriage or something like that, he'd be feeling good. And then all of a sudden, these symphonies would just come into his head. And he said if I'm remembering correctly, he said not note by note, but just sort of all at once. They just come rushing into his head, and he just had to get someplace and write it all down. And he said, he didn't take credit for it. So he had that karma. He had good karma. He was, you know, destined to be a famous musician, and due to past pious activities, and the super soul just made it happen. The super soul just supplied him all the, you know, the necessary ingredients kind of thing, and he put it together, and he did. He became a famous musician. You see? So it's not a coincidence. It's not random. There are, you know, causes behind all these things. But maybe that's beyond the scope of this class to talk about that. But nothing's happening by accident. We had a question over there? Or no, don't worry about it. Yeah. Symptoms of Krishna Prema? Well, I think Prabhupada, or Rupa Goswami mentioned it here, didn't he? Let's see. One was, says, in prema, there is constant engagement in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. So that's the only symptom mentioned here, so probably that's a pretty important one, that one should be constantly engaged in devotional service. And, you know, there's that famous verse in the 10th chapter where Krishna says, to those who are constantly devoted and worship me with love, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Which means that Krishna gives you the intelligence how you can engage favorably in devotional service. And then the next verse is, out of compassion for them, I dwelling within their heart, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. And then that's the verse that I read you the sentence from the purport. So constant engagement in devotional service. That's the one that's mentioned here and probably probably a very important one. So we'll leave it at that. Okay, thank you very much. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.